For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is October the 6th, and we are in Chumash Parashas Mishpatim. We're on page 420. We'll have to pasuk Chav, verse 20. If a man strikes his male slave or female slave with a stick, and he dies under his hand, he shall be avenged. Meaning the slave will be avenged, and we will punish the one who struck him. I'm going to pause for a moment for everybody to have a chance to sit down. On page 420, 422, we just started. Achim yomo yomayim ya'amod. But if he gets up after a day or two, lo yukam, he will not be avenged, ki chaspo hu, for he is his money. He is owned by him. He is his property. So we have two verses over here. This is going to be another discussion about slaves, which always is a difficult thing for us to discuss, since we don't live in a slave culture, Baruch Hashem, and we don't it's not something that we accept as a social norm. And here, the Torah, of course, is addressing a slave situation, and we have a rule here that applies to slaves. Now, we know that the rule is that if one Jew murders another Jew, then the first Jew is put to death. We've already had that rule in Parshas Mishpatim earlier. And here we have a variation on that. Remember that a slave, and here we're talking about not a Jew who is sold as a slave, but rather we're talking about a non-Jew that becomes a slave and is owned by a Jew. Remember we discussed that a non-Jew that is owned by a Jew has a kind of middle ground status. He's not fully Jewish, or she is not fully Jewish, but they're also not fully non-Jews. They're kind of in between. And if they would be made free, they would then become full-fledged Jews. But for the time being, they are neither Jews nor non-Jews. They are a status called slave, which is in terms of the obligation to do mitzvos, is elevated from that of a non-Jew, but is not yet at the status of a Jew. So what happens if a man murders a slave? What happens if a man murders a slave? It's not a Jew, but it's not a non-Jew. What is the law if a man murders a slave? The law if a man murders a slave is exactly the same as the law if a man murders a Jew. If a Jew kills a slave, the Jew is put to death. The Torah here, though, is amending that law slightly. There is one difference between the murder of a Jew, a full-fledged Jew, and the murder of a slave. And that is only if the owner of the slave murders the slave. If it is the owner of the slave that murders the slave, then there is a slight difference. It's a nuance. What is that difference? So that's what we just read over here. If a man strikes his slave or his maid with a stick, and the slave or maid dies at his hand, then the slave or maid will be avenged, which means we will put to death the master that struck the slave. The master will be put to death for killing his slave or his maid. However, and this is the exception, if the slave or the maid does not die, he survives for a day or two, then the master will not be put to death. Why? Because it is his property. So, we are told that if a master strikes his slave or his maid, and the slave or maid dies within a day or two, then the master is going to be put to death. But if the slave or maid lasts for more than a day or two after being struck and then dies, then the master will not be put to death. That is the rule in the Torah. Now, before we even begin to discuss why this is true, let's make sure we understand it, because it's not a law that is easily understood. Normally, again, I'm going to go back to a regular case of murder. Two Jews, Reuven and Shimon. Reuven hits Shimon with a stick. Shimon dies. Reuven was warned, if you hit him, you will be put to death. He hit him anyway. What do we do to Reuven? We put him to death. Murder, put to death. Capital punishment. Reuven has a stick. He's about to strike Shimon. Two witnesses tell Reuven, if you strike Shimon and you kill him, we're going to put you to death. He says, I don't care. He strikes Shimon. Shimon falls to the ground. He's rushed to the hospital. Doctors work on him. And a day passes. 2 days pass. 3 days pass. A week passes. Then he dies. Does Reuven get put to death?
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. He killed someone. Doesn't matter if it took a week. Doesn't matter if it took 6 months. Takes a year. If he killed him, if medically we can ascertain that it was his strike that killed his fellow Jew, he's going to be put to death. Same scenario, but this time it's Reuven and Shimon's slave. Not Shimon, but Shimon's slave. Reuven strikes Shimon's slave with a stick. Shimon's slave dies. Again, with his warning, if you strike him, you're going to get killed. Does it anyway. Shimon's slave dies within 24 hours. What happens to Reuven? He's put to death. He strikes Shimon's slave. Shimon's slave is rushed to the hospital. And the doctors work on him. A day passes. 2 days pass. A week passes. Shimon's slave dies. Doctors say it was because of Reuven's hitting him over the head with the stick. What happens to Reuven? He's put to death. Doesn't matter that Shimon's slave is a slave. He killed someone, he's put to death. Shimon strikes his own slave with a stick. The slave dies within 24 hours. What happens to Shimon?
He's
put to death. Shimon strikes his own slave with a stick, and the slave is rushed to the hospital, and it takes more than 24 hours, and then the slave dies, says the Torah, Shimon is absolved. He is not put to death, not by our courts. The heavenly courts, that's their business. We don't put him to death. Why, says the Torah? Because he's Shimon's property. That's the what. Before we discuss the why, that's the what. So you understand, we are dealing with a very nuanced exception. We are not saying in the Torah that a master who strikes a slave and kills him is exempt from the death penalty. That's not true. If the slave dies within 24 hours, the master is also put to death. We are not saying that slaves can be killed, because if anybody else strikes the slave and kills him, it doesn't matter how long it takes for the slave to die, the person will be put to death. The one exception is if the master strikes his own slave and his own slave lasts more than 24 hours before dying, then he is exempt from the death penalty. Again, what happens upstairs, that's God's business. Not our business. But in terms of our punishment down here, we do not put him to death. That's the what. So before we even discuss the why, I want to highlight the clear and obvious difference between the humane treatment that we had for our slaves and the way the rest of the world treated their slaves. It is unheard of in any slave society that slaves were given the same protection from murder. There may have been laws on the books, even in the United States there were laws on the books, you weren't allowed to kill your slave, but how often do you think that when a slave was killed that the perpetrator was punished for his crime? I would think it was very rare. And if it did happen, it was a slap on the wrist. And certainly in other countries that maintain slavery, to put to death the master society for killing the slave is unheard of. But in Torah, that is not the case. A slave, a slave's life is as valuable as anybody else's life, and no one has the right to kill the slave. If anybody does, they are also put to death, just like if someone kills a fellow Jew. But there is one exception, and that exception is when a person kills their own slave, but only if the slave lasts more than 24 hours. That's what it means, a day or two. A day or two means 24 hours. So the question is, why? The Torah tells us why. Because it's his property. What does that matter? Why should it make a difference if it's the master's property? Therefore, there's an exception after 24 hours. Now, I want to make the question, make it sharper. Let's take the Torah's word at face value. It's his property. Since it's his property, he may do with his property as he pleases. That's what it sounds like, right? It's your property. So if I choose to smash my car into a tree, I can do that. It's my car. So if I choose to kill my slave, I can do it. It's my slave. Maybe that's what the Torah means. But that's impossible for that to be what the Torah means, because if he kills his slave and if he hits the slave and the slave dies within 24 hours, the master is put to death. So the Torah is not saying the master has the right to kill his slave. The Torah is not saying because it's his property, therefore he may kill him. It's not so. He may not kill him. If the slave dies within 24 hours, the master gets put to death. So it's very difficult to understand what is the Torah saying, that because it's his property, therefore if the slave lasts more than 24 hours, we won't put him to death. Why? What does that mean? Because it's his property. So what if it's his property? Either tell me, do with him as you please, or tell me, you may not do with him as you please. What is this middle ground? Well, you can strike him, but just make sure he doesn't die within 24 hours. You understand? You may do as you please. Hit him over the head if you want, but don't hit him too hard, because if you hit him too hard, he may die too quickly and you're going to be put to death. So rather, make sure you hit him sort of hard, so that when he dies, it'll take more than 24 hours for him to die. That's ludicrous. What is this exception? It's a difficult thing to wrap your mind around. What is this over here, this exception of 24 hours?
Why is this not kind
of... Maybe he has an obligation to help him to try to save his life.
Okay, so you're pointing out that if a master strikes his slave and the slave looks like he's going to die, the master certainly has a very strong interest in preventing his death, at least for the first 24 hours. Now, after 24 hours, it's okay. But at least within the first 24 hours, you want to get him to the emergency room. Right? But you understand, everybody else wants to get that slave to the emergency room even after 24 hours. Because if he dies, then the person who killed him would be put to death. The master's incentive is only for the first 24 hours. So it's still not so simple. Why? Because after 24 hours, if he dies, the master's not going to be put to death. So what is this...
Well, but it was in the first 24 hours that he could save his life, he may be well enough to survive the rest.
Yes, so we definitely are showing that the master not only has an interest in doing so, but an obligation in making sure the slave does not die. That's true. But the question is, why after 24 hours is the master not going to be put to death?
Why is this not under the category of thou shalt not kill?
It is. It is. But the punishment is slightly different. That's what we're showing. The prohibition, remember, there's always two things. There's the prohibition, thou shalt not, and then there is the punishment for violating the prohibition. What happens if you do? So the prohibition is the same. Thou shalt not. You're not allowed to kill. If one does, then a slave is like everybody else, except for this slight difference, that if the master is the one who hit him, and the slave took more than 24 hours to die.
Is this a slave who is freed after 6 years?
Or no.
Is this a slave who has
for life.
Year?
This is for life. So no, those two examples are Jewish slaves. This is a non-Jewish slave.
This is a non-Jewish slave.
Yes. That's the middle ground. This is a non-Jewish slave. A Jewish slave, there is no exception like this.
I can't imagine that the owner would want to have that kind of loss. Either he really needed anger management, or the slave did something so horrendous, it almost falls into the area of accident, even though that's a horrible kind of accident. But if Reuven killed somebody else's slave, does he have to make restitution?
Well, we have a rule in the Torah of kim lebe derabamine, which means that if a person does a transgression for which there are two punishments, the person gets the worse of the two. We don't punish two punishments for the same transgression. So in this case, if a man kills somebody else's slave, there really are two punishments. There is a monetary punishment, you owe the guy money, and he's put to death. So since we're putting him to death, he will not pay any money. The estate will not owe money. Okay. But that's you're right about that. That's a sidebar. But I want to highlight what you said. So Mrs. Wittenberg said that the person, the master, is losing money over here. A slave is very expensive. Mm-hmm. Very expensive. Mm-hmm. A slave is not a cheap commodity. Mm-hmm. If anybody has an incentive not to kill the slave, it is the master of the slave. Not only does he have an incentive not to kill the slave, he also has an incentive not to debilitate the slave. You lose your work. You lose your
investment,
either temporarily or permanently. A person who owns a slave, it's hard for us to be in that mindset. But think about it for a moment. Let's use a car. You have a car. You treat your car well. Why? Is it because you love your car? Is it because you adore your car? No, you treat your car well because if you treat your car poorly, then you won't have the use of the car. You want the use of the car. So therefore, you change the oil and you take care of maintenance because otherwise it's going to not serve you properly. If you own a slave and you don't feed your slave, you're going to be the one who's going to lose because you're not going to have a functioning slave. So if you're a smart owner, you will feed the slave properly, you will clothe the slave properly, you'll take care of the slave. If a person is a Nazi, a machshamo, where their whole aim was to work a person to death, okay, so then that's their aim. But that's not the aim of a regular slave owner. A regular slave owner, their purpose is not to kill the slave, their purpose is to get what they can out of the slave, which means they want the slave to perform at his peak capacity. So you send the slave for a physical, and you feed the slave, and you clothe the slave, and you give them good shelter, because you want the slave to perform. That's what you want the slave to do. So a master that is striking a slave, why do they strike a slave? Why would anybody strike a slave? So we know the reason why masters strike slaves is for obedience. That's why they do it. They feel, there's always a question of whether that's going to increase or decrease obedience, but at least ostensibly, at least in the short term, striking seems to be a method of increasing obedience. Fine. So, but every time a master strikes a slave, there is at least a slight diminishing of the slave's ability to work. And if you really hurt the slave, you're really going to diminish his ability to work. So you have to have an analysis of what's better and what's worse. You want obedience, but you don't want to put him out of commission. So if anybody has an incentive not to kill the slave, it is the master of this particular slave. Now, if it's your slave, I don't have that incentive because it's not my slave. So as far as I'm concerned with your slave, it's your problem, it's not mine. So for me, the Torah says, hey, that slave is like a regular Jew, and if you kill him, you're going to be put to death. Don't do it. But the master of the slave, you don't need to increase the incentive for the master of the slave. The master of the slave, believe me, doesn't want to kill his slave. So therefore, there is no need to have as severe a punishment as a deterrent, because the master is already deterred. For it is his property. For it is his property doesn't mean, therefore, do with him as you please. For it is his property means, he, of course, doesn't want to kill his slave. That would be ludicrous, to kill a slave, which is such a valuable investment. So the Torah says as follows. Listen, masters sometimes lose their temper. That does happen. When people lose their temper, then they're not thinking straight. So you can't just leave it up to a person using their common sense all the time. People lose their temper. And since this slave is owned by him, well, people take liberties that they shouldn't take. Therefore, we need to protect the slave from his owner, just like we need to protect the slave from anybody else. So we protect the slave from everybody else by giving him full rights. If you kill him, you put to death. How do we protect him from his owner? Same thing. But it's only necessary to protect him from his owner for the type of aggression that would kill the slave within 24 hours. That's what we need to protect him from the master just losing himself and beating his slave. Oh, one second. You do that, you're going to be put to death. That we need to do. But a type of aggression, which is clearly not the type where the master has lost himself, where it is the obedience type of thing, where the master has the right to say, listen, you're not obeying, and I feel the need, you need to be punished. And therefore, he does administer some sort of a punishment to the slave. Not this aggressive, all-out beating, but something light. Now, sometimes, unfortunately, that could result in the consequences that the master did not intend. The master in that situation where he's got his wits about him, he's thinking properly, is not intending to kill the slave. Unfortunately, sometimes things happen. And in that situation, the master is not put to death. Let me give you an example which is analogous to this, but here we would never accuse the aggressor of trying to kill the person. God forbid a parent is upset with his child and strikes the child and the child dies. Now, I'm not talking about a case of overt child abuse. I'm talking about a regular punishment that a parent administers on a child. Today, in today's day and age, it is rare that it is productive to strike a child. In most cases, the way that our society is, most children will resent being struck, and therefore most parents do not strike the children, and that is the appropriate thing to do. But those of you who are from an earlier generation than I am are aware that that was not always the case. And I have been told stories from my predecessors that it was commonplace to be struck, and that was the way that discipline was meted out. And parents would strike children. Now parents, of course, God forbid, they have no intention of debilitating their child. They have no intention of killing their child. What happens if, God forbid, a parent strikes a child in the regular way of discipline and the child dies? What happens there? The parent is not put to death. Why? Because we presume that the parent had no intention of killing, and a parent has the right to strike his child if it is the best thing for the child's growth. Now, of course, I'm not talking about a child abuse case. I'm not talking about parents who are beating their children. God forbid, that's a whole different story. But in the regular course of events, a parent would not be put to death for killing their child. So too, a master would not be put to death for killing their slave, because it is clear to us that it is not the intention of a master to kill a slave. But we do need to throw in that there is a situation where a master can lose their temper in a way that a parent won't. And perhaps the master will lash out in anger, because after all, it's only his slave, not his child. And therefore, he may actually strike the slave in a way that will kill the slave. Therefore, the Torah says, in the first 24 hours, if that slave dies, the master will be put to death. That will prevent the master from absolutely losing himself. But if it is in the regular course of obedience, and the slave dies after 24 hours, the master will not be put to death. That is the intention, as far as I understand it, of these verses. Questions? Yeah.
So what happens after 24 hours? The slave dies a week later.
Mm-hmm.
Does he pay anything? Does he?
No, it's his own slave.
No, I'm going to pay him.
He doesn't owe it to anything.
So the law, the Jewish law, the court?
Nothing.
He just happens.
What happens is that on Yom Kippur he cries his eyes out for having killed somebody. But he's not put to death. Nothing happens from the court system. Yeah.
Rabbi, what bothers me is that after 24 hours, you're virtually saying, well, it's okay, but it monetarily you'll be hurt. I dislike that.
But think about it.
Amen.
Think about it. You're talking about after the fact. Right now, the master is about to hit this slave. He doesn't know if it's going to last 24 hours. Nobody in their right mind would hit the slave hard enough that the slave might die, because you're putting your life in your own hands.
Why wouldn't he have some punishment at least, rather than just say no?
Uh-huh. I'm assuming it's because we presume that it was not done with the intent to kill.
But that's that's a presumption.
Yeah, well, I think it's a pretty good presumption.
So even if it was like that, it was not the intent to kill. He did kill.
That's true. He did. He did. There are other situations where a person could kill a human being and be completely scot-free, where it is an accidental death.
But this is not an accident.
It's an accidental death. It wasn't an accidental strike. But he did not mean to kill his slave. No master wants to kill their slave. That would be like saying that when a person drove their car into a tree, they did it on purpose because they didn't like the car.
So why is that assumption so definite? Why is it that you're...
I think it's sane. I think you'd be hard pressed to prove otherwise. And the only thing, both of you are responding emotionally because we're dealing with slaves. But if you apply it to a car, neither one of you would say what you're saying. There's no great deal of difference. I'm asking you a question. Would anybody deliberately destroy their car because they don't like the car? You're talking about thousands of dollars of loss.
We're talking about a human being.
Okay, so that's an emotional response.
Not care, you know, okay, I don't care, I strike him no matter what.
But then you may be killed for it. If he dies within 24 hours, you're going to be killed.
Yeah, well, lots of people do it.
Yeah, but
it doesn't matter.
But that's no different. That's no different. Then that's the same.
People do things, so no matter what.
Then you don't need to be a slave for that. That's true with other people too. People hit people, right?
Right.
Okay. So what are we going to do over there? We put them to death.
Then, Rabbi, you're insinuating that he hits a slave. The slave is hurt. He lives beyond the 24 hours. Then he can go back and kill the slave and he's okay?
No, because that's another time to strike him.
No.
That's a second strike. We'll get the 24 hours, we'll start over again. It's only from the first strike.
And I'm bothered.
You're taking a chance if you do that. Nobody's going to do it on purpose.
Well, we don't have slaves anymore, so you don't have to worry about
it. I believe we do have slaves. The United States of America has a bunch of slaves.
But there's the Jewish people.
The United States of America sanctions slavery. In this country, we have millions of slaves. I submit to you that in this country, there are millions of slaves. Millions. Real slaves.
Right now?
Yes. Herman, please define for me what is a slave.
A slave, basically, in my opinion, is a... someone that you completely control, and you are the master.
What does it mean to completely control?
Completely control that he has to do everything, or she, or whatever, has to do everything you want him or her to do.
Okay. So you control what he eats?
Yes.
And you control where he goes?
Yes.
And you control what he's allowed to do?
Yes.
Okay. And do you control when he goes to sleep and when he wakes up?
That's control.
That's correct. Not a child. Not a child.
No.
I submit to you that this country has an inhumane way of punishing people. It's making them slaves. That's what the prison system is. The prison system in the United States is just a very watered-down form of slavery. You take a person and you put him in a system where... you tell him when to get up, you tell him when to go to sleep, you tell him where he can go, you tell him what he can eat, and you tell him everything. Now, it's true there are rules in place over there, what you can't do, but the person has no autonomy. That is slavery. It's a watered-down slavery, but it is a sanctioned slavery.
I wouldn't even call it watered-down. It's legalized. It goes under a different name.
Right.
And
it is slavery, but it's like any other type of slavery. Now, we don't work them necessarily, and we don't beat them necessarily, but sometimes it happens.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it happens.
We
sanction it. It is a way of punishment in the United States of America. Sometimes the punishment is a fine, and sometimes the punishment is slavery.
Then what do you
do? All societies have
what do you do if somebody...
We don't. We discussed this a couple times ago. We only believe in imprisoning someone until you can find out what happens to the person, not as a punishment. There is no punishment in the Torah of imprison the person.
Right. But I'm not talking about the Jewish society, but every nation outside the Jewish Orthodox approach, I mean, you know, England, France, Germany.
Today. That's because they don't want to call it slavery, so they call it imprisonment. Okay. But it's slavery.
And there's a lot of abuse that goes on in prison.
Of course, there's a lot of abuse that goes on in prison.
Rabbi, how do you limit a prison for crime?
Yeah, that's true.
That's a good question, but I reject the notion that we don't have slavery. We have it. It's alive and well.
Then what do you do with somebody?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
But that means our society says, listen, we don't know what to do with them, so we make them slaves.
But what is the other? You are the commander. You give the punishment. If somebody does something to hurt someone else, are you saying that he shouldn't go to, or she shouldn't go to prison?
It depends what he did.
Yeah, it depends what they did, but it's not slavery.
Fine, sure it is. All you're saying is that we don't know what else to do with them, so put them, make them slaves.
Would it be better?
I told you that what we do with POWs is we make them slaves.
Right.
I'm telling you what the United States of America does with criminals is makes them slaves.
Even if they rehab them, even if there's a good rehab
program. I think that our rehab is far better than theirs.
So if there's a rehab program, they're still slaves?
You define it. You have to define in your own mind what is slaves. I'm just saying, just because we have been told that they're prisoners, that's been the word that's been used, that doesn't change the fact that they are slaves.
But what is your solution if they
should I'm not offering a solution. I'm just saying that we should get off of our... the moral high ground and arguing that we don't believe in slavery. It's not true. We all believe in slavery. Mm-hmm. We have it.
We don't believe in this kind of slavery.
I don't know what the difference is.
But the prison system that we have is not always just to punish, but it's to take the person out of the society.
Correct.
Because they cannot
Correct.
Live in a society.
Well, because we said they cannot. Not because they may be able to. We've decided they can't.
We decided they can't. But these slaves are often bought because they haven't been able to pay their bills or for not being antisocial or criminals, but, because they were poor.
So two things.
And they're worked, whereas prisoners are not always worked.
Okay, that is a difference. Here they are worked, mm-hmm. and there they sit and do nothing all day.
I don't know that that's true. I hear sometimes they come out, they're lawyers. I think that's the exception to the rule.
I don't think that is the vast majority. Otherwise, we'd have a whole lot more lawyers in the United States.
Rabbi, they are a lot of successful people that own a large corporation, and they have found out, and there happens to be a lot of them now, that they've didn't pay taxes. They took away money, so they go to jail.
Mm-hmm. That's called debtor's prison. Yeah. They owe money, so they're put in jail.
So that's a quote.
That's slaves.
A slave?
That's they made slaves. They didn't. They did. They stole money, so they made slaves. That's what I think.
In fact, they used to be called work houses.
You're only calling it a different name. They're slaves. What are they?
Well, they don't all turn the money over.
Okay. I throw that out because I just don't think that there is a society in the world that does not have slavery. I think we all have it.
But out of curiosity, if somebody does something wrong, what do you think they should do with them?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I'm only saying that the Torah has its version of slavery and the United States has its version of slavery. I'm not so sure that I like the United States version any better than... slavery is a reality. It exists everywhere. It has always existed.
I think you like throwing that out.
Okay. Next. Next. Pasuk Chaf Beis 22. We take a break from slavery until we come back to it, and hopefully we'll get back to it before the end of the science class. V'chi yiratzu anashim. Two men will fight. If two men will fight, v'nagfu isha hara, and they strike a pregnant woman. V'yatzu yiladeha, and she miscarries. V'lo yia ason, and it will not be, what's the word they use here? It will not be a fatality. Okay, so the woman will not die. She loses the fetus, but the woman does not die. So the two men were fighting. They were not fighting with the woman. They were fighting with each other. But inadvertently, one of them struck a pregnant woman, caused her to miscarry. What happens to the person? What's the punishment? Anosh ye anesh. He will be punished. Kasher yashis alav ba'al ha'isha, in the manner that the husband of the wife shall, it says, your cause to be assessed against him. V'nasan b'frilim, and he shall pay it by order of the judges. So the simple reading of this is that he struck a woman, caused her to miscarry. The husband of the woman assesses how much the loss was, and then the judges enforce that the man has to pay that amount of money. Now, the Torah here does not mean to say that the husband of the woman can arbitrarily decide what it is that the loss was. Because if that were true, then the sky is the limit. The husband says, well, it was a $50 million loss. Pay up. So that can't be the case. And therefore, the Gemara explains, what we do over here is we assess what this woman would have been worth. This is a free woman. But we assess this, what this woman would have been worth on the slave market as a woman who is pregnant and a woman who is not. What is the difference in price? A slave, that a woman who is carrying children is a more pricey slave, because you're going to end up with more slaves. After she gives birth, you'll end up with more slaves. So therefore, she is worth more, and there's a difference in price, and that's the amount that the aggressor owes the husband. Now, we already talked about this. We're going to see a little bit about this more, a little more about this coming up. That when a man strikes another man or woman, there are five things to pay. Five things to pay. You have to pay for the pain. How that's assessed, we'll talk about presently. You have to pay for the loss of wages. The person couldn't go to work. You have to pay for the
medical care.
You have to pay for shame and embarrassment. You also have to pay for the damage. Now, the damage is separate from all these four. Besides pain, loss of wages, doctor bills, and shame, there's something else called damage. What's damage? Damage is the difference in value of the person. If one person cut off the other person's arm, well, now the person isn't worth as much money. So the person he's devalued the person. So in addition to paying for the doctor bills, the loss of wages, the shame, and the pain, which of course those prices are going to be astronomical already, you also have to pay for the difference in value of a person with an arm and without an arm. Here, we are only addressing that last price. The other four are not being addressed over here. This is in addition to paying for the doctor bills, lost wages, shame, and pain. All those have to be paid. What about the damage? What's the damage to the woman? So the damage is the loss of the fetus. The woman herself may not have been damaged at all. All her limbs are intact, thank God. We paid for the doctor bills, so she may be perfectly fine, but there's a loss of the fetus. That loss of fetus is the damage, and that has to be paid for as well. The way the Torah words it is interesting. The Torah says the amount that the husband will assess, that's the amount that the judges will force him to pay. It's a funny way to say it. What does it have to do with the husband? It's the wife, the woman, the mother who got struck. So why does the Torah invoke the husband over here? What if she's not married? Well, if she's not married, you're going to pay her. So why mention the husband at all? So the Torah is mentioning the husband, or at least one of the reasons why the Torah is mentioning the husband over here is because one may, in thinking about a woman who is expecting a child, so the woman herself, obviously, has a connection to this child. Does the father of the child, the unborn child, have a connection to this child or not? At this stage, obviously after the child is born, there's a connection. But prior to the birth of the child, is there a connection to the father of the child? One could argue, no. it is the mother who is carrying the child. It is true the father contributed in producing that child, but the child isn't born yet. The child isn't in existence yet. It's not here. Hasn't been born yet. Therefore, the relationship between the father and child is tangential at best. And therefore, whatever damages have occurred is between the aggressor and the woman. The husband has nothing to do with it, because it's not his. It's her body that was damaged. It's not him at all. The Torah is saying that is not true. That even in the unborn stage, there already is a relationship between the father and the fetus. And therefore, when a man hurts the fetus of a pregnant woman, he is in fact performing an act of aggression, not only against the mother, but against the father as well. Both have been attacked, even though physically it is only the mother who has been hurt, but you have also, by extension, attacked the father. And so therefore, the way the Torah couches it is the amount the husband of the wife will assess to show that he is involved in this as well. That is my understanding of why the Torah here stresses it in this way. But the law is, it's irrelevant whether there is a husband or not. Let's say that she's not married. Let's say he's dead. Let's say the divorce. It doesn't make a difference. Either way, she's going to be assessed in the difference between what she was worth before the loss of the child and after the loss of the child, and then all the other damages as well, and all of that needs to be paid. It is a very hefty amount of money. Anytime anybody hurts somebody else, strikes somebody else, the fine is rather hefty. It is not a simple matter. What do they call it? Assault. Assault is a very, very significant fine in the Torah. The Torah has five forms of punishment that there are in the Torah. The lightest one is to have to bring a sacrifice. Right? Two is a fine to pay. Three is lashes, corporal punishment. Four is the death penalty. And there's also exile, which we have for someone who kills someone without intent. They have to go to exile. So here we have a case of unintentional death. What is this called? It's called manslaughter. It's not murder. It's manslaughter.
Right.
So normally, manslaughter done to a born person, someone who's alive, post-birth, manslaughter would be punishable with exile. Golus. They have to go to one of these cities of refuge and live there. Here it's a fetus. So a fetus is not a full-fledged human being yet. The whole discussion of abortion, pro-life, etc. So we know that we Jews do not believe in abortion. That doesn't necessarily mean that we agree fully with the pro-life platform. The pro-life platform argues that the fetus is a full-fledged human being. We don't agree. We do agree that it is prohibited to have an abortion. We do agree with that. But we don't agree necessarily that the fetus is considered completely like a full-fledged human being. In the sense of the prohibition, you're not allowed to kill that unborn fetus. That is prohibited. But in terms of the punishment, it is downgraded. And so if the punishment for someone who is already born is that they need to go to exile, the punishment for the fetus has to be downgraded somewhat. It is downgraded here to
money.
That's what it's downgraded to. Which could turn into slavery if you can't pay. But it is a monetary fine. That is what it is for the killing of the fetus. Now this is all if the mother was not a fatality. God forbid. What happens if, God forbid, there's a fatality for the mother? Now, here it's worse. Because over here, it really is manslaughter. The woman was killed. Now you have two choices over here. We could argue that it's manslaughter, and therefore the person needs to go to
exile.
That's possible. But we could also argue that if the person was trying to strike the other man, and instead hit the woman, and the woman died, how hard must he have hit the woman?
Pretty hard.
Pretty hard. What if that blow would have actually hit the man he was trying to strike? What would happen to that man? Might have killed him. He clearly hit hard enough to kill, which means his intention was to kill.
That's murder.
But he killed the wrong person. What happens when a person intends to kill and instead kills the wrong person? What happens then? So his intention to kill, but kills the wrong person. You understand? This is a little bit different. This is not as bad as actual murder, where they intended to kill and actually killed the person they wanted to kill, but it's worse than manslaughter. Because manslaughter is, I didn't mean to kill. It was an accident. Here, I meant to kill. I don't want to say I. The person meant to kill, but got the wrong person. That's a little bit of a gray area. Where do we categorize that? This is a debate in the Mishnah. The different sages of the Mishnah debate this point. One of the sages of the Mishnah says, this is murder, and therefore the perpetrator is put to death. The other one says, no, this is not actual murder, it is manslaughter, therefore they need to go to exile, and they will also need to pay for the damages. In this case, there is a payment, even though there's also exile. And that debate finds expression in the next verse. Look at the next one.
Wait,
hold on, read the next one. Pasuk Chaf Gimel 23, Be'im Ason Yeh, if there will be a fatality, V'nasata Nefesh Tachas Nefesh, you will pay, you will give a soul for a soul. Now a soul for a soul generally means
death.
You killed, you'll be killed. A soul for a soul. But this is a matter of debate. One of the sages says it means we put to death the person who killed the woman, because after all, he was trying to murder, even though he got the wrong one. But he was trying to murder. Therefore, he is put to death. Whereas the other sage says, no, this means paying her value. It doesn't mean to be put to death. And of course, there would be an exile as well. We'll get the eye for an eye in a minute. Now, I want to amend something I just said. In this case, there would not be exile. And this is one of those things which you're not going to like, Herman. There will not be exile. There will not be exile because this is worse than manslaughter. This is a concept which we have to become familiar with in the Torah. You see, punishment is painful. No one likes to be punished. On the other hand, in certain ways, punishment is a privilege. What do I mean punishment's a privilege?
Better than death. Sorry.
Well, sometimes death is the punishment. Sometimes that's the punishment.
Oh, it's a redemption. No?
It's a redemption. If the person did a horrific transgression, now they don't get punished, and they live out their life, and they go to the next world, what's going to happen in the next world? What's going to happen on the other side? They're going to get punished. God doesn't forget these things. Either a person atones, or they do teshuva, they repent, or they get punished. There's no other choice. And the punishment could be here in this world, the punishment could be in the next world, and the next world is much worse than this world. Much preferred in this world than the next world, even though we don't like punishment. But it's better here than there. The Torah prescribes certain types of punishments. Exile is one of them. A person will not go to exile if what they did wasn't bad enough to deserve exile. But a person also won't go to exile if what they did was worse than what exile is meant to atone for. The Torah won't water down the punishment. If the person did something which is too horrific to be punished with exile, but not horrific enough to receive the death penalty, that person is in the middle. And that person will better cry their eyes out on Yom Kippur, but they will not be punished by the court down here. They fall into a gray area where they did something which is too terrible for exile to take care of it, but it's not quite bad enough for capital punishment. This is that example. Here the person meant to kill, and they actually killed, but they got the wrong person. The sage that argues that the person does not get put to death argues what they did isn't quite bad enough to deserve the death penalty. But on the other hand, it's definitely worse than inadvertent manslaughter. And therefore, gullus, exile, isn't good enough for this person. And the person is now in a gray area, and there is no punishment in the Torah that will cover this person. They will have to pay damages, but this person does not deserve the atonement of exile. They need something else in the middle. What are they going to do? They're going to have to sit and really figure out how they're going to make amends, because they're in hot soup. Yeah,
that works. That means that's really worse than death, because at least with death you've got that redemption option.
Okay, in certain ways it's worse. The difference is that the person does have many years ahead of them, hopefully, in which they can try to make amends. What should they do? What does a person do if they did a horrific thing and they don't have a way of, there's no punishment? What do they do?
You would make a slave.
Well, that's...
We always have that to fall back on.
The person needs to try to their best to try to make amends to the family, do whatever they can.
Good.
Yeah.
Alice, in the beginning of the class, you had mentioned how the person before murdering the slave or something was given warning. I mean, in all of these instances where somebody murders somebody else, do they have to have been warned?
We don't give capital punishment without warning.
Well, that's what I
thought. Yeah, there always has to be a warning for capital punishment. Right. So Dina's bringing up a good point. In a case of actual murder, mm-hmm. premeditated murder, if there was no warning given to the person, we're not going to put them to death. Mm-hmm. There you have another example. The person is a murderer, but they walk away because mm-hmm. we didn't warn them. So they walk away from it. So what do they do? Right. Now it's Yom Kippur. They're a murderer. They killed someone in cold blood. Imagine the guilt the person walks around with after that. It's very difficult to live with oneself after doing something so terrible. And a person has to learn how to atone.
It depends upon the individual.
That's true.
So crying criminals, they don't work.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to read up until the end of the paragraph before we break. We have a couple minutes. We're actually a minute over time, but let's just read quickly the rest over here. This is the famous Chaf Dalet 24. Ayin tachas ayin, an eye for an eye. Shein tachas shein, a tooth for a tooth. Yad tachas yad, a hand for a hand. Regal tachas regal, a foot for a foot. Kiviyah tachas kiviyah, a burn for a burn. Petsa tachas patsa, that is a wound that doesn't draw blood. For another wound that doesn't draw blood. Chabura tachas chabura, that would be a wound that does draw blood, for a wound that does draw blood. And here we have the famous explanation of the Gemara that this does not mean, God forbid, that if someone pokes out someone else's eye, that we will then do that to that person. We do not do that. This is a monetary value. If the person damaged the other person's eye, we assess the value of what he did, and he has to pay for it. Again, five payments: damage, pain, medical bills, shame, and lost wages. And here, Herman, I would argue that our system of money is far more humane than the system of you cut off his hand, we'll cut off your hand. I don't think that that is necessarily humane. But this is it's a monetary punishment for these things. Okay.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.